Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live Sustainable Food Forum held in London in September 2023. This session was titled Making an Impact, Learning from Global Innovators. This was the second session under the same title across 2 days, but with a different focus and different guests. Our panel is made up of innovators defining the future of food, covering a range of activities. Some are still embryonic, but all reflect a rethinking of every aspect of the way we source, produce, package, distribute, promote, buy, and consume food and drink. Your host is the journalist and broadcaster, Shay Rhodes.
This is quite an interesting one, and hopefully you'll all be able to learn quite a lot from this. We're looking at breakout companies, companies that have had a massive impact on the food industry in recent years, and we'd like to learn a little bit more about how that happens, how it works, what the challenges are, the difficulties, and what successes that you're facing. Hopefully, very inspirational. I get the feeling there's probably a few people here hoping to start their own innovative new food company. So let's start off with introductions. Could we start with yourself? Yes.
Okay, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to be here. It's a real pleasure. And my name is Matilde de las Rivas. I am co-founder and CTO of Leftproof Bioscience. We are a Spanish company focused on precision fermentation. We use yeast cells for producing recombinant proteins that we can eat. It's like using the yeast like small factories that are able to make not only animal-free versions of the proteins that you are usually consuming, but originally from the animal, yeah, but also to make it in a scalable and affordable way that can be reach a price parity when speaking to the final product you consume. Mm-hmm.
So you're producing an ingredient, and you'll be selling business to business to a producer. And how about yourself?
I'm Farah Di Mata. I'm co-founder and CSO of the BioToCoat. We produce two types of solution because BioToCoat mission is fight against food waste and use of the plastic in food packaging. So we have the solution. It's the first one. It's edible coating. We apply on the fruit surface. After dry, creates a semi-permeable layer that reduces transpiration rates, so we can maintain the fruit fresh longer with the same nutritional properties, is without change anything in flavor, and you can extend up 2 weeks, more or less, the shelf life of avocado or mango, up to 1 week strawberries, because it's more fragile. And the other hand, we have, with the same patent, we have a edible packaging. We can replace plastic in multiple applications, such as vacuum bags, sachets, or foams. No? And addition to that, we can add natural extracts on this edible packaging. So in this case, has flavor, has taste. And in this case, you can put, we have some prototypes. I can example one. We have rice. And you put in the edible packaging based on tomato sauce. So you put all the packaging with the rice in the boil water. The packaging will be dissolved. And the sauce is incorporated to the rice. So can taste and flavor, etc.
We're living in the future, guys. Welcome. and I'll obviously come back to a lot of that. And we have one final person, who's Aurelia. Could you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Hi there, I'm actually talking to you from Tel Aviv. Apologies I couldn't be there in person, but great to be able to join such a great forum. I am the Chief Transformation Officer for Aleph Farms. We operate in the field of cellular agriculture. Our current first product is a beef product, a steak, that's produced fully through bioreactors. And we aim to produce food security and tackle environmental challenges derived from conventional agricultural methods. We've been around since about 27, and we're one of the leaders in the space of cultivated agriculture.
I hear you guys about to start a factory in the UK, is that right?
We did recently submit our dossier for regulatory approval in the UK, and we were the first to do so. So fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed, yeah. First to do so. Does that necessarily mean first to get regulated? We'll find out. Great stuff. Okay. So I guess one of the things, and we're going to open this up to the audience, hopefully, in about 20 minutes or so. So please have any questions. But one of the biggest questions that I have is, you know, food is typically a relatively conservative space. People don't like to mess with what they eat. They like to eat the same things over and over again. And food producers don't like to take too many risks. How do they react to you when you turn up with your new additive created in a new way? What's their reaction?
I think it's still developing. I think it's really, really important to communicate to the ecosystem and to the consumer to understand that science is behind food. And so like the things that are really commenting, cellular agriculture is not just something that is happening, it's something that we need to solve the actual situation of the way in which we produce the food that we consume. And I think that one of the most important things is that the consumer has to understand that there is nothing bad when we mix science and the final food. And this is something that has been happening always. For instance, in our case, in precision fermentation, I think I have mentioned this in a previous talk, but I like to explain like this to my mother. I mean, we use yeast to produce things, but yeast has been used to produce beer and to produce cake and a lot of food you consume, and it's something really common for us. And now we are using the metabolism of the cell for producing ingredients that we need that can solve real problems that we are facing within our current situation. But there is nothing strange about it, and it's, I think, part of the thing that we need to do is to communicate this and to make people understand that this is something that it's going to help, and we all are trying to achieve the same, that it's the same tasty solutions, but in a sustainable way. Mm.
I can hear listening to you that you've had this conversation before.
Yeah, well, of course. Maybe. Yeah. In our case, we have a particularly work with a protein that is sweet, is 2,000 times sweeter than sugar, and I use this example because I think it makes easier to be understood to the people, because sometimes it's like too much abstract when you speak about precision fermentation. It's like, what? I mean, it's like it's another way of achieving the same, of obtaining the same in an affordable way. And I think that projects like this that are working on technology but with the taste in mind, because this is what we want to achieve, is the exact same food and the exact same stick and the exact same taste of sugar. I think, well, that's what we're trying to do, and technology is really evolving really fast. So I think we are near, and now it's the moment to like shouting that we are already there, and people has to understand and from all the perspective, regulatory and ethical, and be convinced that it's something that is happening.
It's coming, it's possible. What do you see as the potential? So it's a protein that is sweet. What do you see as the best applications for it, or what are the most easiest kind of applications that you can see?
It's a protein that has been well known. There are like four or five common sweet proteins in nature that were already known. This concrete protein is in the seed of a tropical fruit, and you could extract it from the fruit, but it wouldn't be affordable, and it wouldn't be, I mean, it's like in a 0.001% of the seed. But as it is like nearly 2,000 times sweeter than sugar, it can be used like not for substituting, because there are a lot of food matrix you need the sugar for another thing that making it sweet, that the sweetness, but it allows to make final products that taste as sugar as the common one to reduce the excess of sugar that we are accustomed to, and it doesn't provoke the glucose spike. It can be consumed by diabetes people, people with diabetes, and it's also thermostable, so you can work with some products that need high temperatures, and it's also stable at acidic and basic pH, so it can be used in drinks like Coke, carbonated drinks, so the range of application is really, really huge. The only problem we have to face with is the price parity, because we are competing with the price of the sugar. So this is where technology has really everything to do and to improve. And this is where we are really, there has been already a work that has been done by several companies, but there is a really big difference in the yields we are obtaining now, modifying the strains of the yeast. Every year there are better works and people who is working and who knows the metabolism of different strains. And so I am here because I really know that the point in which we are is a point from which we can really make a project that is affordable and that is scalable, and I can start speaking with big companies that need this kind of solution, because I know that my system is scalable and had enough good yields as to provide the final factory to with the amounts they need. So
you sound quite confident. yeah, as confident as you can be. Aurelia, I think feel like I should throw to you now, because I'm thinking a lot about consumer perception. How consumers perceive your product and how businesses perceive it. I first heard of your company on social media, which, I can see the look in your eye already. I just wanted to see what you said, because, you know, doing what you do, creating meat in a lab, is the kind of thing that gets social media very excited in not a good way.
I think actually it's not necessarily correct. There's a lot of benefits to what we're doing that really drive it towards the consumer. Firstly, it's completely traceable, and you know, post-COVID and in terms of zoonotic diseases, these diseases you see coming through the supply chain, the thought that somebody actually can trace back what they're eating, what's on their plate, they know that it's been done in an aseptic condition, they know that it's free of these diseases, it's free of antibiotics, it's free of a lot of the risks of your conventional supply chain, is actually becoming very, very important to people. Beyond that, I think you have this, you know, concept that we're working very closely with very high quality chefs to really show people what you can do with this food, to show them that it is a great diverse alternative to conventional agriculture and conventional meat. So in terms of pushing it through and getting it, like you said, on social media, but with the right messaging, the right education, we can be in actually a very, very good spot in terms of consumer acceptance. And you add to that the fact that literally at some point there's not going to be enough food. And I think, you know, my colleagues here have picked up on that. This is very much in some ways a necessity, and it comes after our adoption of dairy. It comes up after our adoption of even eating animals. Humanity did not grow up in itself of eating animals. It was something we derived in our food chain. So it's a process, but I'm very confident that we will have that consumer acceptance.
And listening to your approach, it sounds like, I mean, I've met some other people today involved in producing a very similar product, and they're often focused much more on restaurants and trying to get their product out in that way. Is that the same for you, or are you looking more at a more consumer-facing approach?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely. It's such a great way to reach people, and no one can cook the piece of meat that we create better than those chefs who really know what they're doing. They can make it really bring out the flavors and the taste for people. They have the followings. We've announced that we're working with Chef Michael Samuelson, who's very well known in the United States. We'll soon be announcing another chef who will be helping us kind of drive this. But absolutely, our play initially is B2B. Of course, the attention down the line will be that it'll be B2C. But for now, we're B2B as well. Absolutely.
And we've just done a session on packaging. So I find your product endlessly fascinating. You can spray it onto a fruit to protect the fruit. Is that correct?
Yeah.
But it can also be a separate packaging of its own.
Yes.
What's it made from?
Yeah, no, because when you have A formula, it's a powder, it's a blend of the powder, and when we can apply in the nebulization or spray or immersion in the fruits, but if we change the processing, we can make the packaging. So we can use some traditional machines to work with packaging to do something.
And did you say it can be formed? So you can
form
it into shapes.
Yes.
You can
we can form it, you can blow.
Flexible. Wow.
We can blow like a plastic and plastic bags, this normal plastic bags. And we can of course form. And but when we can add the extracts, we need a special machine who produce and dry the film as well. And the end we have the film.
Okay.
Yeah.
But with the extract in it.
Yes, with extracts or chocolates or whatever you want.
And what's the product made from initially?
It's only food ingredients, so it's like a blend of starch, proteins, and bioactive compounds. We have some patent bioactive compounds. We put them together, and we can change the quantities for the application.
Oh, that's interesting.
Also, yes, because in case of the fruits, for example, each fruit has a respiration rate. So it's not the same solution for avocado than for strawberries. It's completely different. So the surface, the food surface, everything. So we have a know-how to make some five kinds of coatings. And for the films, we need, if you need put more extracts or more condiments like salt or olive oil, you need to put more powder, no? So, but it's okay. It's flexible. It's sealable. It's.
And when you approach people to talk about your product, what are their biggest concerns? What are their main questions? Are they worried about where it comes from? How durable it is?
Yes. Well, in case of the coating, we work directly with the producers, no, of fruits and vegetables. Our product make the change in the whole value chain, no? Producers, distributors, and end consumer, because it's benefit for all agents of the value chain. But the producers is the beginning. So when we put more early, it's better because works a lot more time. So for them, it's very easy to see the benefits of the products, because they have losses, the quality or the appearance. So for them, it's very easy. So, and for end consumer, we make the all in marketing information, and they said they bought less fruits than they can, and they want to meet because the food waste. So for the coatings, well, but for the packaging, I don't know. I think it's more difficult for two people know the packaging for sachets or for spoons to replace the plastic in normal way. But for the edible packaging, I think we need to do a lot of efforts in making this.
Yeah.
This visible, no? Because, well, for me it works because I'm very busy, I work a lot, so I want to stay in my home and put some in there and not worry about the throw up, the packaging, and then, so for me it works, but I don't know if the most of the population want to be try this one.
It's a potential convenience food, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, it's conventional, yes, it's para convenient food, yes.
Yeah. Aurelia, I want to ask you a little bit more about regulation. Obviously, you're doing something that's very new. And when you approach governments, when you approach regulators, they will not have heard anybody talk like you do. What's that process like?
It's not without its pain, but I will say governments generally have been very pro. We've also been very involved in working with different governments on how they should regulate this. It's a novel food. Singapore led the way. Singapore has had cultivated food for about 4 years already regulated. So they kind of led the way on this. We're leading the way in various other countries, the United Kingdom, Switzerland, and our home territory of Israel. Food security, food stability has become such a big thing in the global world, particularly with geopolitical events. You know, we've seen what has happened with Ukraine. The governments recognize a real need for this, and they're doing what they can to really push it. We need more. We always need more help. We're really helping to drive that agenda for them and trying to give them an indication of how to do this. They're familiar with pharma, they're less familiar with food in terms of utilization of this equipment, etc. But we're finding them actually very receptive, but it's a process, it takes time.
Yeah, clearly. Also, you're attempting to recreate something, obviously, which has been around for centuries and all of us have experience of. And it's a very varied thing, meat. I mean, pork is different to beef, you know, shin is different to, nothing's the same. How do you go about designing your product and formulating your product so that it meets the needs of people, of carnivores, fundamentally, who want to taste fat, they want crunch, they want different textures, they want meat?
So there's a couple of points. First off, we're not trying to be meat. It's very important to get that messaging out. It would be inaccurate for us to say we're a meat replacement. We're trying to be meat. We're trying to be a diversity play, an alternative option, a kind of a third wave of food. You have your beef, you have your dairy, and here we are with cellular agriculture. In terms of the taste, it's a fantastic product. I'm biased, but for instance, it's a very moist product that we create because of the cellular structure. It means that it withholds moisture much better than, for instance, a regular steak. So it's very tender, it's very juicy, it's very hard to kill it when you cook it. So I think for all those reasons, you know, it's comparable to what you're eating when you have a steak on your plate, and it's tasty and it's nutritious. It's very high in protein. So it's a good sell overall for everyone on that basis of what the actual food content is that we've created.
But you're very careful to make clear that this is new, different, not the same, not trying to be the same, and to try and carve out your own space. Do you think that's important?
I think it's super important. You know, meat is such a personal taste and food is such a social thing, and it's very much kind of an individual view on what you're tasting and how you're experiencing it, but also kind of a collective experience on food. And it's very hard to dictate to people, you know, what they think of something they're putting in their mouth. So we are creating something that's unique. We are creating a novel type of food, which is nutritious, which is tasty, and is in line with a meat product that you would get from a cow. But like I said, it's very important that we are not trying to replace meat. We're not meat. We're going for the diversity play.
Yeah. No, totally. I can almost picture it now. Actually, going to, you know, a Chinese restaurant, and I can have my chili with pork, chicken, or cellular protein.
Cultivated.
Yeah. So it's one of my options, rather than not knowing once I've ordered the beef which thing I'm going to get. Do you have the same with Matilda? Do you have the same with regulation and governments and how people look at your product?
Yes, because in the case of this protein in Europe is still novel food, and we have not only the problem with the novel food in this case, but also the problem with the GMO, because we modify the yeast so they can produce the protein. And even if the yeast is not present in the final protein, because you isolate it, but as you have used one type 1 microorganism, but you have to start all the regulation pathway and to say that you are working with this. And it's in my personal experience, I have learned a lot about what regulation implies, and it's really difficult, because even when, for our own purpose of knowing a little better the regulation landscape, we are also producing an enzyme that is used to coagulate milk, and it's nothing, schimosin, it's present in the I don't know the name in English for cuajo, I don't know what you use for clotting milk.
Okay.
Right,
yeah.
And there is an enzyme which is the main responsible of the clotting, okay? And it's really important for cheese making. And it was like the first enzyme that was produced by precision fermentation and used in the food industry. So for us, scientifically speaking, it's easy to produce it. So we are producing it just to, as a company, start producing an enzyme by precision fermentation that you can sell. So to start all the regulation.
And would that also come from a GMO route?
Yeah, but as it has been already approved, previously approved, if you replicate exactly the same process, that will supposed to be easy. In theory, any company could should be able to produce in the exact following this exact protocol that has already been approved to use this in the final cheese making formulation. Even following the protocol is really difficult, and you have to start and write a huge amount of documents and fillings and forms that make you realize how difficult will it be when speaking about not only a novel food, but we work with different strains of yeast. And this will be even more difficult because you have to present this strain and make everyone sure that it's also safe, even if you are totally sure that they are safe because they are really have a lot of things in common with others that have been already approved. But I mean, it's difficult. My experience is science was really difficult, but it has been surprisingly less difficult than making the regulation will turn. Yeah, it's at least for me, that I didn't know exactly how to move it. It has been I guess it has an objective. I understand the objective, but I think now there are too many things to fight against. Technical difficulties, perception of consumer, regulation, price parity is maybe too much.
And do you get questions asked, particularly when your product is based on food? When your product, the raw materials are essentially food products.
Yes.
Do people question you about that in terms of are you essentially denying food from one person in order to produce packaging or edible packaging for somebody else? Is this waste food? Is this potentially food that could be used somewhere?
Yes. First of all, we can extract for the waste or the byproducts. Yes, we can. But for regulatory, in case of the coating, no. We use the virgin material.
Virgin materials, yes. Yeah.
Because even using virgin material, it's complicated to make the regulatory. Yes, we need to get in closer because I know we need to guarantee food safety, because it's very important. But I think we need to be more close, the innovation and the regulatory more close. No? And for the packaging to replace plastic, we can use, of course, for the yes. But for the edible packaging as well, not. But the quantity of we use for this is very small for the extracts. And we can imagine that the tomato we don't buy to eat, but it's also good for make the extracts for the edible packaging. So we can use this kind of stuff. It's not the super fresh stuff, but it's in very good condition to make this.
That's interesting. And that's, I guess that those sorts of concerns are crucial when you're at the scientific, at the kind of formulation stage and coming up with something, thinking about how the regulators are going to react, if you're using waste materials, if you're using new processes and so on. Does that affect the process or what you actually come out with in the end, if you know that this is just going to be hard? And Aurelia as well, jump in if you have a perspective. Are there scientific technical changes that you make because you know that the path you're on is going to be just difficult to get regulated?
I don't know what Aurelia thinks about it. For us, it's something we face with, because, for instance, we already have this protein in a yield that can be used for, that could be okay. I mean, it's enough yield, but if I go on with the regulatory pathway, I cannot modify the protocol by which I am obtaining it. So when people ask me if I have already started the novel food process, I haven't started, because I want to improve the efficiency, because I know that we are really reasonably good. It would be great to be better, to have higher yields, so we are still working in improving some of the strains we are working with. So until we have definitely defined the protocol through which we are going to obtain it, we cannot give it novel food. We cannot start the process. So it's kind of a will, because if you scale it up in another facility, you also have to be sure that it's going to work when you have scaled it up. So you have to take it into account when you are developing the scientific pathway or the technical pathway through which we are going to obtain it, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are at the stage of scaling up, right? I assume, yeah. As you're putting in planning applications and stuff. That must have been a really technically difficult process. And did you have to change your final product in order to guarantee that you'd be able to scale that up?
I think, you know, you're continually iterating on your process, but like you kind of alluded to, and as did, you know, my colleagues on the stage, it's an issue of planning. You need to be very careful about, you know, making sure that you're submitting at the point in the process where you're very confident with it. Because once you're submitted, and that's the basis upon that working, and you can continue to iterate, but then you're kind of back and forward between a process. So it's a very fine line as to the timing to run ahead and do that regulation versus really work on the process and keep on defining, keep on iterating, keep on improving. So I think, you know, the answer is that definitely you have to be very cognizant of regulation in selecting your processes. Of course, there are all these standards that are applied to food products. You have GMP, et cetera. So it's very much a question of timing and being very confident in where you're at that point of submission, that you're good to go towards commercialization once you get the approvals.
And I guess this is probably asking a bit too much detail, but how come you guys have got there so fast?
Fast is relative. We've been around since 2017. We did our first product in 2018, which is the world's first cultivated steak. So, you know, it's still a process of months and years. We're waiting. We're hoping very imminently to get Israel and Singapore approvals. United Kingdom will take longer. So, you know, it's still very much a process. It's kind of one step at a time in the right direction.
Understandable. Before we run out of time, I'm going to throw this open to the audience, and please jump in at any point from now on. I'd love to hear your thoughts, even if it's not a question, if it's just a thought, an example, a personal observation, experience. I'd love to hear from you guys. I know it's the last session. But tell me a little bit more about. So, I mean, we've heard that regulation in Israel and Singapore was. I mean, presumably you started earlier, and the relationship's been there. What are the differences when you're trying to get a product regulated in the EU, for instance? Does the EU have particularly stringent requirements?
Yeah. As far as I know, yes, it's much harder to start working with some products here. For instance, the sweet protein I was speaking about has been already approved in USA, and there are some places in Israel where you can work with it and you can put it in the final product. In Europe, the FMI, it's really harder, yeah. So you have to take that in mind, and to your commercial strategy has to be aware of this. And if you are a B2B business, maybe transferring the protocol or selling the ingredient to countries in which it's going to be able to use it. But yes, Europe is harder for
us. And do you anticipate that if you're able to crack the EU regulatory kind of barriers, that will open the rest of the world for you? Or are you still going to have to keep jumping with each country?
Like I really say, one step at a time. I think you need to keep jumping. I guess if you have already passed the European regulation, it will be easier to pass the other ones, but they don't ask exactly for the same things. I mean, it's not like as you have one, you have the other. No, it's like there are different markets. It's really easier to move some kind of ingredients in USA and in some other landscape, like in Southeast Asia. Things are moving really, really quick, and it's easier to make some advances there. Yeah.
Interesting. Do we have anything from the audience yet?
Hi, just a question on the cell agriculture. As you're scaling up, what is the biggest challenge for you at the moment? Is it to do with the cell media? Is it to do with waste? Are you reusing waste? I'm interested in what's the next biggest hurdle for you as you're starting to scale up.
So, yeah, what are the challenges in scaling up? I guess it'll be very different for all three of you, such different products. So, I mean, if we start... Actually, let's start with Aurelia. What were the challenges that you guys faced scaling up?
I think it's like any technology. You know, we like to think about kind of the Tesla model or renewable energy models. There's significant costs involved in new technology. in terms of the cost of equipment, the cost of scaling up the factories, et cetera, et cetera. It's real material costs. It's why we need governmental help, private, public partnerships, grants, incentives. It's an industry problem. And I think, again, my colleagues on the stage will agree with me that the costs involved overall in scaling up this any new technology are large, especially when you're trying to work towards price parity. So I think it's overall just ensuring that you have sufficient support on the financial side to build up and go forward and run and reach those economies of scale, which we see ourselves getting to in a few years.
I don't know. May I ask a question for Aurelio?
Yeah,
maybe
for
I am wrong.
Please do.
Because I
absolutely
in cell culture, I was aware, at least in the cell culture I am most familiarized with, that one of the biggest problems was the price of the media you have to use, in which you have to put like growing factors that has. And I don't know if you use growing factor, and I would love to know if it's still being an issue when you. Or maybe you have reached another way of scaling up and to maintaining the structure and the growth of the cells without needing them, because that was like my perception that was impossible to make a price parity of the final product if you still were using this kind of proteins.
Yeah, no, it's a legitimate question. We do use growth media, which is, we like to call it our baby formula. It feeds our cells and keeps them growing as if, it was in the insides of the cow, and you're talking about glucose and proteins and everything else. And it continues to be that we work on our supply chain to drive down those costs. We work with colleagues who are operating also in the cultivated space. There's a lot of joint work in order to drive those costs down. Everybody's, looking for the same ingredient supplies. So as we work on extending our supply chains, we drive down our costs of the growth media. As we work on more efficient processes for how the growth media is used to keep it to exactly the right amounts, that also drive down costs. So it's a continual process on our part to make that better and better, and like I said, drive that price parity.
Mm. Aurelia talked about government's incentives, grants, and so on. How have governments treated you on that front? Have they been open? Has it been easy to find people to invest or to put money into your company to help you get started?
Well, in my case, we have some public fundings now.
From
Spanish government and Catalonia government as well, in Spanish and Catalonia. But we are starting our first round, so the private investment. So I don't have experience in this, but public yes, because we contribute a lot to sustainability and eliminate use the plastic. So
And potential jobs.
Yes.
I believe.
Yes. Yes.
And how about yourself?
In our case, we haven't raised money, and it isn't now in our perspective because we belong to a kind of holding group there in Spain, in which there are other companies from the biotech. Biopharma ground, so there, it's like we have a in-house private capital, so it's an easier way to start a startup because we have been able to make an investment in facilities and in devices, equipment, and people. We are more than 18, and we have more than 4 million invested in facilities, so that doesn't mean it's easy, but it's easier because you are not wasting or investing your time in asking for money, which is really exhausting. So I don't know if I will know how to do it. Well, I guess I will try. But
I have a question.
Yeah,
first. Hi, first of all, I love your product. This is really, I'm an end consumer of your product. But you are thinking only to sell B2B. It's not B2C anyway.
We will, that is the intention down the line. Our vision ultimately is to be able to provide high protein quality food to multiple people around the world. As with everything, it's about driving the company forward as a new technology, and that starts with the B2B play. That was what we have, we decided was and has been discussed was the best way to do it, to really get that consumer acceptance driven out there to drive the economies of scale. And then gradually we filter down, but we will eventually be looking, of course, at the B2C market. But for now, we're focusing on B2B as we go into that initial side of commercialization, which we're very much hoping will be in the imminent future before the end of this year.
Oh, thank you. I'm a vegetarian.
Yeah, right. Okay. So, and this is very interesting to you, is it? yeah. as a vegetarian. That's, I always find that interesting. Any other questions from the audience? There's one back here. We'll just get a microphone up to you, save you having to shout at this time of day. It's quite uncouth, really, isn't it?
In a new category, like we're talking about lab-grown meat or, you know, using different types of, you know, there was another one earlier we was talking about making oil out of herb and electricity. How do you decide when to collaborate with the other players in that field against compete against them? Right? It seems that there's a number of people in lab-grown meat, for example, and there's a lot of technology being built, and it's very efficient if you all collaborated. But then on the other side, you're trying to give stakeholder value for the investment they're giving. And, you know, what's your experience of being part of these networks and these kind of ecosystem plays against being a just, you know, a company that keeps everything to yourself and is just highly competitive?
I mean, Aurelia, you've talked a bit about collaboration and so on, particularly when it comes to growth media. How does collaboration work with you guys?
I think it's super important for our industry. Cellular agriculture is new to the world, and it's important that we kind of drive it forward together, you know, be that with the regulators or governments or policy or whichever way that works. Our product, for instance, is very different from chicken nuggets. We're a whole cut, we're a beef. So to work for companies who are in different cultivated foods, it's easier for us to have those conversations, and it's easier to work together to drive forward kind of a mutual agreement that we need the industry to do well. And the best way to do that is by really having that collaborative aspect. So I think, you know, there very much is this sense of helping one another in the industry. We all talk a lot. We all give each other insights. We all feed into the governments and do what we can to push it as an agenda. We all recognize the importance of it. Food stability is critical.
But then, of course, once one of you gets a big contract with Unilever or someone, what happens then?
Hopefully Unilever would want cultivated chicken nuggets as well as cultivated beef.
Absolutely. I just want to thank you, all three of you, for your insight. I've learned a lot. Not coming from the food industry, I've learned a lot today, but particularly from this panel. And thank you very much to everyone for coming and taking part.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, I'd like to tell you about Tastes of Better, part of the Food Matters Live event series, where you can experience the latest food innovation firsthand. You'll get to discover value-adding ingredients and meet the technical experts behind them. Explore every element from flavour, texture and mouthfeel to shelf life, nutrition, sustainability and cost efficiency. Check your eligibility and apply for a seat at the table over at foodmatterslive.com.